Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
On behalf of the Saturday Night Live at Pine Lake Speaker Meeting, please help me welcome tonight's speaker, Rebecca H. from Seattle.
I'm Rebecca, I'm an alcoholic. I say Seattle loosely. I did all my using in Seattle, but I live in Auburn now, and I was raised over here in the east side. So they asked me, you know, where do we put where you're from? And so I just put a blanket statement of Seattle. But anyway, it's an honor to be here tonight. I'm a little nervous. At my home group in Los Angeles where I got sober, when you say you're nervous, the audience goes, aw. Thank you. No, I'm a little bit nervous, but but you know, being up here in this deal, it's not about me. You know, it's not about me at all. And I'm gonna do my best to take me out of the equation. You know, I'm just up here telling my experience, strength, and hope, and you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how I found a loving God. You know, in these rooms. And Pixie, I want to thank you so much for asking me to share. What an honor, and a surprise, but a great honor. Thank you. And then it's also neat to be able to, be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with my family. We're all drunks. My dad, who has 37 years of sobriety, and his loving partner, who has 37 years as well, she is 3 months on my dad, or 6 months on my dad, and I'm pretty sure she doesn't let him forget that. So, you know, but it's really neat to be able to sit in a meeting with my dad and you know, every time that I speak, my dad is in the front row, you know, every single time. And you know, my dad is my best friend today. And that is definitely a gift that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. I also have a little brother in here who has about a year and 4 months or 5 months sober, which is an absolute miracle as well. And you know, I have a little brother my boy, who's down in the childcare, which hopefully we're not saving a seat for him. But, you know, if we are, I hope that Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well for him too. But he's down in the childcare facility, and I'm so grateful that there are meetings out there that have that available. You know, and when they're not, I take my son to meetings with me. You know, we sit in the back and we try and be as respectful as we can. He's 7 years old and it can be a little bit difficult sometimes. He's, you know, he's an active boy and, you know, but AA has embraced us. You know, they have embraced us and they have welcomed us. And I can't tell you what that means to me. You know, especially my home group. You know, my home group is the Empire Way. We meet every Wednesday night and it's the best home group in the world. And if you don't think that about your home group, get another home group. Empire Way is my home group. That is my home. And when we show up there, you know, people love my boy and they take him outside and they throw the ball with him with the dog and they, you know, they love him, you know. And again, I can't tell you what it's like to be a single mother and to have AA surround me and my family, you know, because I need to be a mom. I need to be a mom, but I definitely need to show up here too. And AA is my number one priority. It has to be for a drunk like me. I can't just do this thing halfway, you know, half measures of illness, nothing that the book talks about, you know, and I've tried half measures and we'll get into that in a little bit. I've tried half measures and half measures availed me nothing, you know, and so, you know, so I bring my boy to meetings with me. I'm just here to share my experience, strength, and hope in a general way. I don't have a canned pitch. I didn't practice in front of the bathroom mirror today to you know, I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth. I did pray, you know, I remembered to pray and I do have, you know, my experience, my strength, and my hope, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, what it's like now, you know, and I'll do my best to be able to share that with you guys. And again, like I said, it's a great honor to be able to do that. You know, I was born in Houston, Texas, and those of you that have heard my dad speak, hear his great talks about Texas and where he comes from, and he has great pride in where he comes from, and so do I. I claim Texas any chance I can. I only lived there for 2 weeks, but I still claim it. just because my dad loves it so much, you know, like it just sounds so cool. But I was born in Houston, Texas, and my parents met at a bar called the Brass Monkey, and I think that's so fitting that that's where I come from, you know. And, you know, they had an alcoholic marriage, and I'm not here to tell my dad or my mom's story, but that's, you know, just a little bit of the facts. They had an alcoholic marriage, and it ended in divorce when I was three. My mother had inherited a large sum of money and took me and my three brothers to move up to Seattle. And in 1979 or 1980, I'm not quite sure which year, I was pretty young, we moved up to Seattle. And this is where I was raised. And, you know, by the time I was eight, my mom had gone through all that money. And my parents had joint custody. My dad had then joined AA and had moved up to Seattle as well to be with us. And like I said, my parents had joint custody, and we would, you know, spend some time with my mom, spend some time with my dad. And my mom went through that money by the time I was eight, and she just kind of walked away. You know, she had enough. She couldn't deal with being a mom. And my dad raised me from then on out, me and my three brothers. And I have done inventory, you know, and I know that my mom did the best job that she could with the tools that she was given, you know, but as an 8-year-old little girl, you know, I didn't understand that. And I grew up feeling very different and very alone, you know, and so I just always remember feeling that. I was completely self-obsessed way before I took my first drink, you know, and that's a sign of alcoholism, is that complete self-obsession, you know. And I also remember, you know, my dad, who was an AA and who was raising me, was my hero. You know, he was my hero, and he was an AA, and he, you know, he got me involved in church activities and 4-H and some positive things in my life as a little girl, you know. And I remember thinking, you know, I didn't want to drink, you know. And I remember my dad putting me in alcohol and drug classes when I was a young girl and educating me about alcoholism. And I remember going to Alateen, you know, and I made a conscious decision that I was not going to drink. And then, you know, I hit junior high. And things get a little awkward when you hit junior high, you know. And I started hanging out with a group of kids that I thought were cool, you know, and they wore the AC/DC Metallica shirts, and, you know, they had all the boys hanging out with them, and I just, you know, I don't know, I was attracted to that. And so I started kind of hanging out with them, and they drank, and they smoked pot, you know. And I remember telling myself I wasn't going to drink and I wasn't going to smoke pot, and I would watch them do this until this cute boy, I think his name was Jason Schoonover. It's so funny, I remember his name. We were all hanging out in an abandoned bathroom in Juanita Beach, and they were passing around this crushed Coke can with, you know, funny little green stuff on it, and it got to me, and I just took it, you know. And then I went to my friend's house after smoking that stuff, and I stole some schnapps of some sort. I can't remember, peach schnapps or something gross like that. And I remember drinking it, you know. And then I remember going home, and I remember, you know, and it's so cliche, you hear so many speakers talk about this, but it's like I could breathe for the first time. Like, I no longer cared about what you thought about me. I didn't care. It's not that I got pretty. It's not that I got smart. I just didn't care. You know, and I remember laughing, you know, like really laughing. And I'll never forget that feeling. You know, I knew, you know, I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I absolutely fell in love with it. But I also remember the next morning, I promised myself I was never going to drink again. And that's like, that's my drinking career right there, you know, at 12 years old or 13 years old, however old I was at that time, drinking, because it was my solution. It helped me deal with life. And then promising myself, you know, I'm just not going to drink like that anymore, and not being able to stop. And that was that young of an age. And I didn't drink for about 6 months, and then I picked it up again. And at that point, I drank every chance I could. And, you know, at 13, I wasn't a daily drinker, obviously, but I, you know, I believe I had lost the power of choice whether I could drink or not at that young of an age. I really do. By the time I was 14, I got kicked out of school for drinking vodka in the bathroom stall, and I was running away from home, and my dad, not really knowing what to do with me, put me in my first treatment center, and that was the age of 14. And I got sober at 35. So there's a lot of years in between there. When I got out of my first treatment center, like I said, we lived in the East Side area. I found a place called Hilltop Fellowship Hall. And I know there's some people here who got sober there, and that's awesome. So some people I've known here for over two decades, you know, from that place. And some of them have been able to stay sober, and some of them have not been able to stay sober. I don't think it was Hilltop. It's just, you know, I don't know. I wasn't able to stay sober because I found Hilltop, and it was more like a kind of a hangout for young people, you know, and I wasn't willing to follow any kind of direction on how to stay sober. You know, I just wanted to kind of hang out in AA and date different people, you know, and go to all the different conventions and all the different dances. Anyone remember the 449 Club? Yeah. So I, you know, we used to do that kind of stuff, and it was fun and it was exciting. And I was hanging out with people that were my own age. But like I said, I have a disease of alcoholism and I'm unable to stay sober on the unity side of the triangle alone. I'm unable to stay sober by going to Alcoholics Anonymous alone. Now, there are people that can do that. More power to you. I'm just not one of them. And what would happen to me is in my teen years, I spent in and out of AA. You know, I would get about a year sober, and life would happen, right? And I don't have the tools to be able to deal with life sober, that I would get thirsty, and I would need a drink, and I know what takes that pain away. And I would drink, you know, and then things would get so bad while drinking that I'd have to get sober. And like I said, I did that cycle my whole teen life. And by the time I was 18, I got, I went to my second treatment center at Thunderbird Treatment Center in Renton. And I was there for 3 months and I got out of there and I went right back to Hilltop and I met a guy, he tattooed my name on his shoulder and I thought we were in love. And actually, I had my first son, Elliot, when I was 20 years old. And I had every intention of being a good mother to this little boy. Every intention. You know, people were trying to talk to me into giving him for adoption. People were trying to talk some sense into me and some reason. And I was like, no, I can do this. I can be a good mom. And if I had stayed sober, maybe I would have. And if I had worked the program, maybe I would have. But I didn't work a program. And again, I convinced myself that maybe I was crazy. Maybe just this time I need some relief. I can control it. And I went and I got a bottle of wine and I drank that bottle of wine and that phenomenon of craving occurs and I am off and running again. And my son's dad was a heroin addict. And I don't blame him for this at all. It was my curiosity that got me started on heroin. But I was curious and I wanted to know, you know, what that deal was about. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And in 8 days of that relapse, I had committed my first felony. I had lost my son. I'd gotten kicked out of where I was living. My dad had taken the car back. And obviously I wasn't going to college anymore. And that's in 8 days. You know, tell me there's no progression to this disease. You know, and I was off and running again. And this time I found myself as a 20-year-old girl, almost 21-year-old girl in the streets of downtown Seattle. And I have absolutely no hustle. I'm raised on the east side. I have no idea, you know what I mean? And I find myself in shooting galleries in Capitol Hill. My dad had to take me out of one, you know, and I was 106 pounds when he came and found me to take me home to detox me on his couch, you know, just holding on to me like it with tears in his eyes going, man, you know, what the hell happened? You know, because I tried to kick heroin with speed and that didn't work too well. But I stayed out there for a couple of months, you know, and just kind of danced around a little bit. And then I had lost my son, Elliot. And I went to my third treatment center, CDRNR. I don't know if anyone is familiar with CDRNR, but that's a behavior modification work therapy program. And it's long term. And I completed that. You know, I was there for a year. And the only reason why I stayed there for a year is because my son was CPS involved and they gave him back to me when I had been there for about 6 months. And I had my boy with me and I couldn't leave with him because he was still a ward of the state. And so I completed that program and I got out and things were going well. I was young. I was at the right place at the right time. I landed a job at Boeing. I had my son back with me. I had my own apartment. Everything on the outside looked good. And I thought, you know, this will fix me. This was my solution. I just needed everything on the outside to be okay, and then I'll be okay. And it didn't work out that way with me. I still had the disease of alcoholism, and I was dying inside. And once again, I turned to alcohol. And then alcohol, I turned to the heroin and the cocaine. And they, you know, the state came and found out I was using again and took my son. And I had fought to try and get him back. And they put him, eventually they put him in an adoptive foster care home. And I fought and I fought to try and get him back and I couldn't stay sober. And then I had a reality check and I looked at that little boy who was then at 3 and I realized that I could never give him what this family could give him. You know, there was a mother, there was a dad, he had a brother, he had a dog, he had a house, they had careers, they had money, they had everything that I didn't have. And I walked away. I walked away from that little boy. And he's now 20 years old, and I haven't seen him since he was 3. You know, and I hit the streets, and I hit the streets really hard. And I'm not talking like a couch commitment every once in a while on a friend's, you know, house. I'm talking about in the alleys underneath the bridges. And I lived like that for years. And I got used to living like that. And I never thought that I would live like that. I remember being on the streets as a young woman and just slowly, you know, keep crossing the line. I'll say, I'll never do that. I'll never be like that person. And I kept crossing the line. And I kept crossing the line. And then I found myself, you know, looking at my nails one day, and they were dirty, you know. And I just remember, you know, people would walk by me on the street, and they would look at me with complete disgust, or they would look at me with they just wouldn't pay any attention to me. And I just remember thinking to myself, oh my God, this is not who I am. This is not who I am. And I cannot stop. I cannot stop using. And like I said, I lived like that for years, you know, the jails and the institutions and the insanity, you know, of shooting galleries and crack houses and, you know, just the insanity, you know, detox facilities and not being able to stop. You know, there were years my father didn't know where I was. He would get updates for me from the local police officers who would call him and say, we had a sighting of Rebecca. She's still alive, you know, and that's how my dad would know I'm alive. You know, I thought I had tried Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I thought that AA had failed. You know, that this deal didn't work for me, that I was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself, you know, and that I was too crazy for this deal. And so I couldn't come back, you know. And what happened was, you know, I'd been out there for a while, and I'd gotten a little bit more time sober and trying to do the dance with AA. And what happened was, you know, I caught a couple cases, and I ended up in drug court again. It was my third time in drug court. And this time I had 3 felony drug cases, and they put me on the methadone maintenance program. And I thought, that's my solution, you know, the methadone maintenance program. And then I met my second son, my son who's downstairs. I met his dad playing sober softball, and I had Michael shortly after. And Michael was born addicted to methadone. And I'll tell you, I'm going to say this right now, and I say this every time I speak. Anytime I talk about kids and this disease, like, it is not pretty. It is not pretty. And I hate standing up here and admitting what kind of mom I am when I use, you know, because my son is my number one thing in my life today, you know, along with AA. He is everything to me. And I love that little boy with everything inside of me, you know. But yeah, you put alcohol in my system, and I am not, that all that goes out the window, you know, and I am just living to drink and living to use. And that is just the kind of person that I am. I am completely powerless over this deal, you know. And so I had my son, and what makes me sad is that when my son was born into this world, there was no one there to greet him. There was no one there. My dad had sent flowers, you know, but they had a really hard time with me being on methadone. And you know, it must have been heartbreaking, you know, knowing that a child was coming into the world like that. You know, but there was no one there to greet him, to love him. I had pushed everyone outside of my life because of this disease, you know, and it's not like that today. I'll tell you, my son has so much love around him, you know, a lot of it here in these rooms, you know, but I was in drug court, and I was, you know, trying to do the deal in drug court, and I was on methadone. And then I think I stayed away from the drugs and stuff for about 3 years drinking. And then I convinced myself that I was on methadone, so maybe I could drink normally since I'm on methadone. I really thought that. And I went out and I got a couple beers. And at the time I was working at Starbucks. I'd been working there for about 3 years. I got a couple, because I made that decision. I cannot wait. I can't wait till after work. I went on my break and I bought like a 6-pack of Heineken. Heineken's harmless, right? And so I don't have any way to open this beer, and I'm not cool where I can open it with my mouth or anything like that. So I crack it open, and I get caught, right? My new boss catches me. Well, she didn't catch me drinking, but she caught some green, you know, from the bottle, and she confronted me, and I threw something at her, and I called her, you know, a name, and obviously I got fired, but this is like my grandiosity after just 2 beers, you know? Like, I mean, and so I get fired, and I'm off, and I'm drinking again. You know, it's the same story. Same story. I'm drinking again. And then, you know, I tell myself I'm not going to do any hard drugs. I'm just going to drink. And then I remember one Christmas, actually, you know, I had forgotten it was Christmas. I didn't even call my family. And I remember them coming over, you know, just as, and the look on their face, just, they just wanted to make sure that I wasn't in the bathroom dead with my son hovering over me. You know, like, what an awful thing for parents to have to think about, you know, on Christmas. And that's how they spent their Christmas that year, you know, and I was drinking. And pretty soon I started using the drugs again, and I lost everything again, and I lost the apartment, and I lost everything. And I had a friend of mine who flew me down to Los Angeles, where my mother lives. And the plan was I was going to stay down there for a couple of months, and I was going to pick up the pieces, and I was going to move back up to Seattle. And I had every intention of getting sober again, you know, and I went down to Los Angeles, and I remember getting on the plane. I drank and I used until I got on the plane. The stewardess came around. I had $20 in my pocket, and the stewardess came around, asked me if I wanted anything to drink, and I said no. And I thought, I'm doing good, right? And so I get off the plane. I go into 7-Eleven to buy a pack of cigarettes, and there's the alcohol right there, and I have no mental defense against that first drink, and I start drinking again. And I'm down in Los Angeles in an area that I am unfamiliar with, and I'm drinking in MacArthur Park, and I'm leaving my son with my mom while I'm out running and gunning all night long. You know, and a couple of weeks that went by, and I had a moment of clarity one night, and that moment of clarity, and again, I hate mentioning this stuff, you know, about what kind of mom I am when I'm using, but that moment of clarity came when I had that little boy with me, and I had been smoking crack all night long, and I had been drinking, you know, and I was with a stranger, and we got into an altercation over money. I wasn't giving him my last $40, and there was this big altercation in the middle of the night, and this woman came. And she came to my defense, and she helped me get my stuff out of this car, and, you know, this big drama scene. And I went over, when it was all over and done with, I went over to go thank her, and she looked at me, and she told me exactly what kind of mom she thought I was. And she said, look at you, she laid into me. And my ego didn't want to hear it. My ego got puffed up and got back in her face, but you know what I did? I heard it. I heard it. And I had a moment of clarity, and the very next day I went into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just had that moment of clarity, man, where I just, you know, the alcohol just wasn't working anymore. It wasn't quieting the voices anymore. It wasn't my solution anymore. And I crawled in here. I mean, I crawled in here, you know, and I got sober in a place. I was in LA, like I said, and I walked into this group, and people knew I was new. I think my mom and I had like this huge argument, like out front or something. I don't know. And it was just this nasty scene, and I'm walking in, and I'm thin, and, you know, just, you know how we look when we're new. And, you know, but no one looked at me in distaste. They came up to me, and they sat me, and they brought me right over to a woman. Her name was Dasha, I'll never forget. And Dasha had me sit next to her in that whole meeting, and she connected me with other women that were sober mothers, and I got numbers that night. And she got a directory, and she circled the meetings that everyone went to on the regular nights. Just said, if you go to these meetings, we will all be at these meetings. And I was just willing and desperate enough to follow some direction. And I called the next day, and my first direction was to not go buy cigarettes in a liquor store by myself. I couldn't. The alcohol was still talking to me, you know, but I got sucked up in this deal. I got sucked up into it. I can't remember what the speaker said that night. There's a lot of speaker meetings where I got sober. I can't remember what he said that night, but I just remember the love, and I remember people surrounding me, and I heard the music, you know. But there was still that voice inside of me that said, you're too crazy for this deal. Your problems are too complex. You've tried AA. And what I realized after really doing AA is that I had never did AA at all, that I just hung out on the fringes. I came in here trying to look hips looking cool, trying to save my face, trying to hook up with him, you know, and I never really got down to the nitty gritty. You know, I came in here as a taker. I never got in here and tried to help set up chairs or help clean a bathroom after a meeting. Never once even occurred to me. When I was a teenager, my dad used to give me $2 to every meeting. I thought he was paying me to go to meetings. I didn't realize that was for the basket. I think Brent pointed that out to me one night, actually. You know, I was a taker in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would come in here hips looking cool, looking at my phone, They didn't have phones back then, but if they did, I'd be the one texting, look at me, I got all these, you know. That's what I'll tell you what, if you pull out a phone in my home group, they will snatch that out of your hand. And I don't mean that to sound, I just mean that people taught me to show some respect in what people are trying to get sober. And people taught me how to sit and listen, you know, to sit and listen. And that I didn't know anything. All those prior years of being in AA and all those prior years of being sober, I had to push all that aside and be a newcomer. And I was, man, I was desperate. I was desperate as a dying could be. And I was also still on methadone. And I thought I was sober. And the thing, and if you're on methadone and you're here tonight, man, welcome. You know, I'm just here telling my story. But I knew that I had to get off that drug. It's synthetic heroin, for those of you that don't know. And even though it was doctor prescribed, I had to get off that drug because I wanted what you had so desperately. I wanted what you had. Like, I was sold from that first meeting. And I started, you know, I stopped claiming sober time. And I started getting real with people. And I said, you know, I'm on this drug. I'm on methadone. And they said, okay, cool. And then I would just kind of, you know, start with negative, you know, I'm at negative 40 days of sobriety, you know, instead of, you know, and people just loved me. They're like, how many milligrams are you at today? I'm like, oh, I'm at, you know, 80 or whatever, you know, and what happened was I went down a milligram a day. It was 100 milligrams and I stood in that methadone line for 4 years. And I went down a milligram a day. And when I got down to 40 milligrams, I went into detox facility and I went into the detox facility for 10 days and it wasn't easy. And the day that I got out, my sponsor and my sobriety sister picked me up. And that's my sobriety date, which is July 25th, 2011. And I cherish that day. I cherish that day. And I remember, you know, I wanted a real sobriety date. And I'd worked so hard to get off the methadone. And I was sick. You guys, I was sick. You know, it is. I had severe withdrawal. But I'd come to the meetings and I felt better. You know, I literally felt better. And I remember, you know, when I had 2 days of sobriety, I couldn't sleep. And I was pulling my hair out, man. And I was like banging my head up against the wall and screaming in pillows. And I called my sponsor at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, hey, someone had given me some sleeping medication. And I said, can I please take the sleeping medication? I just need some sleep, man. I cannot sleep. I'm going crazy. And she said, you can. You can take it. Now, mind you, this isn't doctor prescribed. She said, you can take it, but you're going to have to change your date. And those 2 days meant so much to me. It meant so much to me to have a real date. I toughed it out. And it wasn't easy. And when I got sober, I didn't have a phone. I didn't have a car. I wasn't living with my mom because she's Section 8 at that time. She went through all of her money. And she was Section 8 and I couldn't stay with her. So I lived in a homeless shelter. And I had nothing. And that's just where my disease took me. You know, that's where my disease took me. It stripped me. You don't have to have a story like that to be in here and to be in AA. You know, it doesn't really matter, actually, what your outsides look like. It matters, like, how alcohol affects you, you know. But that's just what my story looked like. I had absolutely nothing. But my sponsor directed me to go to a meeting every single day. Every single day. She didn't care that I was a single mom. She was a single mom herself, actually. She'd come down off of methadone herself, too. She'd been a heroin addict. She'd lost her daughter. I couldn't pull anything over on her, you know, and she told me, I want you to go to a meeting every single day. And you know what? People then come and pick me up at meetings too. It cracks me up how sometimes newcomers are like, can you pick me up? And they're 2 blocks away from the meeting, you know, like I lived and I'm more than willing to do that. I am more than willing to pick up anybody and take them to a meeting. But my sponsor directed me to go, you know, to take the bus to a meeting, to show some willingness. And for a drunk like me, I needed to, because in my 20s when I was in AA, everything was given to me, and that didn't work. It didn't work for me. It works for some people. It didn't work for me, you know. And so I needed to put some effort in this deal, and so I did. I took a bus to every meeting, and she got me home every night. You know, she or one of my sobriety sisters or someone, another woman in AA got me home that night. You know, and I lived in pretty nasty living conditions for my first 9 months of sobriety. But again, like I said, every time I came to AA, you guys wouldn't let me feel sorry for myself, you know, and I felt better and I felt the magic and I felt the love. And you know, I came in here just with my head low, you know, and you guys lifted it up. You guys saw something in me. I remember there was this woman named Marianne Kay, who's got 40 plus something years sobriety down in LA. And I remember the first time she came up to me, she remembered my name. And I can't remember what that felt. I cannot forget what that felt like with her remembering my name. It had been such a long time since someone had been so happy to see me. A respectable woman, you know, had been happy to see me and remembered my name. And I tell her that, you know, every chance I can, you know, what an impact that made for me, you know, and slowly life started coming back into my world. You know, I had, you know, it was simple stuff like take esteemable action and you will get self-esteem. Okay. You know, that makes sense. So I would take the bus to the meeting and I had a sense of pride of that I was getting there on my own, that I wasn't working anybody over. You know, when I had about 9 months of sobriety, like I said, I moved out of the living conditions I was in, and I moved into the Midnight Mission, which is in downtown LA, is the main office, and the apartments that they have for the single families are in Inglewood. And I lived there for 20 months. And that place was great, you know. That place was amazing. You know, I got a work there at a little restaurant, and while I was working there, I was able to go back to school. I was able to save some money, and my son and I had a large one bedroom apartment, you know, that was you know, transitional housing, and we were able to, you know, kind of work. I was able to work my way back into society a little bit, you know, and I stayed at that restaurant job for 3 years, and then I was able to go back to school, like I said, and I became a surgical technician. And I had a 4.0 GPA, you know, and I believe the reason why I was able to go to school and I was able to hold down a job and I was able to practice these principles is because I learned how to practice these principles in AA, you know, by honoring my commitments, by showing up early, like I said, by not being a taker and by giving back to AA and showing some respect. And it started showing up in the outside world. You know, and so I became a surgical technician and I did really well scholastically. And then it was time for me to do my internship. And for those of you that don't know what a surgical technician is, it's basically the surgeon's right-hand man during surgery. And so, you know, I have to retract and I have to hand instruments and I set up the OR and I do all that kind of stuff. And you know, it was really exciting, but I got this doctor that, you know, wasn't very nice. He wasn't very nice at all. And he barked at me, and I just remember, you know, like, I didn't show it then in the OR, but he told me to step back and, let someone else, you know, take over for me. And when the case was over, I went to the bathroom and I just started crying, you know, and I just remember just thinking, you're a junkie. You're never going to amount to anything. You're a loser. Why are you even here? The operating room? Are you kidding me from where you come from? You know, like, this is just loud going over and over and over. And then the next thought came. And the next thought was, yeah, well, you may be a loser. You may not be good at what you're doing, but I'm not going to give up. I'm going to give it every chance I can, and I'm going to scrub in with this guy every chance I can. And I learned that in AA. I learned that, for those of you that don't know, Clancy. Like, I'm not afraid of anyone after meeting that guy. I was at that guy's yard for 4 years, you know, and lots of other old timers, you know, who just taught me to suck it up. You know, who taught me not to be run by my emotions anymore, you know, and I did. I scrubbed in with that surgeon every chance I could. Every time he turned around, I was gowning and gloving him. And I earned that man's respect. And I mean, everyone hated the surgeon. Everyone hated, he was tough. He was tough. And he pulled me aside one day and he said, Rebecca, it's not that I'm a jerk. He said, it's just that I just told this lady earlier today that she's got breast cancer. She's going to die. You know, and we had a heart-to-heart conversation, and he started teaching me things, and he started taking me under his wing because he knew he was intimidating, he knew that I was showing up, and I was just having the heart to be there. And when I left my internship, he wrote a letter of recommendation for me, and on that letter of recommendation, it says that I'm the only surgical technician that he's ever done this for. And that's AA. That is AA. See, you can come here, and you can just show up and be a taker. But I guarantee things like that probably will not happen in your life. Maybe they will, I don't know. But I know that that happened in my life because I showed up in AA. When I went to my home group in LA is 800 people. We meet every Wednesday. And they dress nice and they look nice. And I tell you, I came in with no dress. I had a suitcase, I had a kid, I had 20 bucks in my pocket. That's it. And I look at these people and I would think, oh my God, if you knew what kind of alcoholic I was, you would not accept me. He would not love me. I mean, my head was so loud. And thank God I had sponsorship direction that told me to go work the room. And I was terrified. I mean, scared to death. And she told me she would make me. I would sit down, she would snatch me up and make me work the room. And I'd work the room and I'd meet a couple people. And eventually, like I said, that meeting, that 800 people meeting became my family. I'd show up at yard. I'd show up. We do these things called moves, you know, where on, we'd go to people's houses and we'd help them move. And, you know, we just do all these wonderful things as a group, you know, and it healed something in me. And I was able to show up and scrub in with that surgeon and get that letter of recommendation, which I tell you helped me find a job, believe me. And so I am now a surgical technician. I was in Los Angeles for 4 years, and a year and a half ago, I made the decision that I want to move back home. One, because it's, you know, my son's dad lives up here, and I wanted my son to be raised with his dad. And the other is because, I have lifetime amends up here. I have my father and Debbie are up here. My family's up here, you know, and it just felt right in my gut to move back to Seattle. And I did it the right way. You know, I talked to old timers and I followed direction, and it took me 6 months to move from LA to here. And I didn't know what the job situation was going to be like. I had a couple odd end jobs working at plastic surgery joints in LA. And I didn't know, again, you know, because you have to do this Washington State licensing thing, you know, health licensing thing. And I've got priors, you know, and I have a drug felony possession, you know, and I didn't know what that was going to look like. And I was scared. Again, I didn't want to do it. I thought, they're not going to give me any, you know, I'm not going to find a job. There's no way. And I just, my sponsor said, you know, it's not up to you. Just take the footwork, do the action, and leave the rest to God. And that's very simple action. I can do that. Okay. And so I started taking the footwork. You know, I had to go to the courthouse and get all the documents and this and that. And then I turned them in, and they gave me my license. They said it had been 5 years since your last conviction, and you know, there's nothing violent on your record, so we're going to give you this license. And I thought, okay, great. So I start looking for work, and I land a couple job interviews. One was with Group Health, one was with Swedish. And I interviewed for Group Health, and Group Health, it was a panel interview, and there were several people that were interviewing for this particular job. And they called me, it was a holiday weekend last July, and they called me and they said, hey, we just want to let you know you're our top candidate. You're on. We're excited. Welcome. And I was like, right on. And then HR called me. And HR said, you know, this is unfortunate. I just got done talking to our lawyers and we're looking at your record and you're just too risky. We cannot hire you. And my heart sunk. My heart sunk because I thought, oh my God, you know, I remember, you know, telling my dad, and I remember thinking I let my dad down, you know, and I remember just, you know, feeling just like, oh my, you know, like what's going to happen next? How am I going to survive? What am I going to do? This obviously isn't my field. And then again, because of trained defeat in AA, I remember you take care of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous will take care of you. And I knew that if I just put AA first, if I just do the next indicated thing, that whatever will happen will happen. And you know how I know that? I know that from the old timers that are here doing this deal today, you know, that go through the ups and downs in life. We're not promised a pretty life. You know, we're promised sobriety and we're promised to never go through anything alone. You know, we're not promised our families back. We're not promised a great relationship. We're not promised fame and fortune and money. We're just promised sobriety. You know, and comfort where we're at in sobriety. We can live comfortably in sobriety. You know, and so I thought, okay, you know, well, I'll just do the next indicated thing. And I started going to meetings and I started talking about it and kind of making jokes of it. And then, like I said, Swedish had gotten a hold of me, and then I did a second interview with them, and then I dealt with HR and a third interview with them, and then they wanted me, and I told her the same thing. I disclosed myself to HR. I was like, look, this is on my record, but I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I will jump through any hoop that you want me to if you want to hire me, if you still want to go through with this. And she said, hey, you're on. You're in. And now I've been there for next month, it'll be a year, but I am a surgical technician working in labor and delivery, helping bring new life into this world on a daily basis. And I'll tell you, and I'm good at what I do, let me tell you. I'm good at what I do. I never saw that. on that detox bed. I never saw that. I never saw that. I would have never guessed that for me. I would have been happy with a Section 8 house and a carton of smokes. You know, maybe some guy from the mission, you know? Those were my great, goals in life. That's the only place I saw me. God has so much more for us, you know, if we really do this deal. And then another thing, when I mentioned my dad, you know, and the relationship my dad and I have today, you know, in the years of drug and alcohol abuse and you know, in and out and getting close and then relapsing and, being a mother and knowing how much I love my son, I can't imagine what that must be like. And I know there's a lot of parents that deal with that in here. I remember having a conversation with Debbie, actually, you know, when we were talking about the ninth step stuff and I tried to do kind of a dry amends to my dad. I didn't really know, you know, what to do, what the next indication was. And we sat down and we talked about it. And, you know, I will never be able to make it right. I will never be able to make it right. I will never be able to give, that relationship back with Elliot that was lost. I will never be able to get all those years that were lost, you know, of having to worry about a daughter on those streets. But I can show up today, you know, and I show up the best way I can, not because I have to, but because I love my dad, because my dad's easy to love. And those of you that know my dad know that he's easy to love. And I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky to be able to share this deal with him. You know, I go and I show and I bring him up coffee, not because I have to or because I'm a great person, because believe me, I'm not, but because I love seeing my dad. I love the pride he gets when he introduces me to 20 people walking down the aisle. Hey, have you met my daughter? Man, that is priceless. That is priceless. You know, the relationship that we share today, unreal and a complete gift. You know, when I hit 1 year of sobriety and my home group does this great tradition where, when a person turns one and they're actually in the middle doing this deal, we go down to Norm's on their 364th day and we watch them from 10 o'clock to midnight turn one to make sure that they don't drink, that they get their 1 year anniversary. And I had a watch and there was probably what, like 150 people there at Norm's. And I asked my dad to show up. I really wanted my dad to come and see what kind of program I was working. I wanted him to know that I was finally in good hands, you know, and he was reluctant at first, and he should have been, because he had seen me turn one, I don't know how many times, several. He's given me a coin, you know, we've been there, done that. And he came, he made the decision to come, and we sat there at that watch table, and they asked my dad to speak down there at one of the Pacific Group meetings, and so my dad spoke on a Monday, and my dad, who's amazing, gave just this great talk, you know, and people just adored him and loved him for good reason. And then on Tuesday, I turned one, and we went to the watch table, and we were surrounded by 150 people. And what my dad didn't know is that everyone's sponsor directed to be there. They weren't there for me. I mean, they were, but, you know, we all show up for each other. And Debbie was on the phone, too, you know, at midnight, and everyone sung happy birthday, you know, and watched me turn one. And then when I took my cake at the Wednesday night meeting, I got to do 10 minutes that night. You know, and something healed with my dad and I that night, that when I turned one, something healed with us. And he came down, and he, when I lived down in Los Angeles, and he flew down every time I took a cake, and my dad's spoken down at Pacific Group, you know, meetings, and they love him down there. It's like a second home group for him down there. And what a gift that AA has given our family, you know. And then again, you know, watching my little brother, you know, and the life that we have together, you know, as we were close as kids, you know, and it's priceless. And I want to tell one more story. I know everyone's trying to get antsy and everyone wants to get out of here, but I just want to tell one more story. When I was down in Los Angeles and I was living in the Midnight Mission, I had never been a runner before. Never been a runner in my life. And they put on a 5K little deal, you know, it's like 3.1 miles. And I thought, okay, sure, I'll do it, you know. And I trained for this 5K, and I'm running on my little, you know, treadmill, and then I do the 5K, and I finish the 5K, and I have this grandiose idea. I want to run a marathon, you know. I mean, that's just how I think. I'm either a 4.0 student or I'm in the street shooting dope, you know. I'm like marathon runner, or I'm, you know, couch potato extraordinaire. And so, it's just how I think. And so I'm like, I want to run this marathon, and I start training for the marathon. And people are like, yeah, okay, Rebecca. And that made just fuel me more, right? And so I start training for this marathon, and I ran my first marathon in LA. March 2 years ago. And the first thing I did when I crossed that finish line was call my dad and tell him that I did it. You know, and then I caught the bug, and I decided to run the Seattle Marathon. And when I ran down to the Seattle Marathon, Dick Billings was there, and my dad was there. My little boy was there. My son's dad and my brother, who was still working on a story and reeking like it, was there. He calls me the next morning, the drunk call, you know. Oh, you're so inspiring. It's awesome. Anyway, I met my dad and Dick Billings at mile 5, and I thought, oh, cool. It was 26 degrees, too, and I was fine. My face was numb, but I was fine because I was moving. These guys were hanging out. Mile 5, they saw me, took a quick picture. I kept running. I was like, okay, cool. They came and saw me. That's awesome. Then I saw them at mile 9, mile 18, and the finish line. It was awesome. And I tell you, when I ran that marathon, I ran by streets I used to work. I ran by that King County jail. I ran by bridges. I ran by houses where friends have died, and I watched them die. I ran by horrific memories in that marathon, and there wasn't a dry eye the whole time. And I finished, and it was unbelievable. And then I had an opportunity to go to Rome, Italy, and run a marathon over there with the Midnight Mission, all paid for. It was unbelievable. I ran a marathon in Rome, Italy. You know? And then I got back, and we moved here, and I ran Seattle again, and then this last March, I ran Barcelona, Spain. You know? And it's not about running marathons. It's about, I never pictured this stuff on the detox bed. I never knew life could be this good. You know, I don't know what your story is, what yours is going to look like, you know, but I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's too much evidence for me not to. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.